My name is Steve Moore. I'm with the Murdoch Trust, and I've been asked to introduce our guests that are going to lead this session, which is titled Instructing and Improving Education, Microfinance in the Third World. And we just decided that rather than me standing up and reading their biographies, because I've just met them both too, that I would just ask them two or three questions that would kind of help you and help us all to get to know them a little bit. Professor James Tooley is going to go first. He's a professor at Newcastle University, and then Chris Crane, who is with Edify. So let me just ask Professor Tooley a couple of things. So you're coming, you're currently working in England at Newcastle.
Yeah, I'm known as an absentee professor, actually. I have a job there, but I spend most of my time in West Africa and India and other countries. So I'm seldom there. Last month I was there 5 days.
And so your background, obviously you've been in higher education for most of your career. What is it that has gotten you to be interested in this particular project?
My interest has been in education since I was a teacher in Zimbabwe some 25 years ago. And ever since then I've been concerned about how to improve the quality of education and what role should government play in that process.
And tell us about your own family. What's kind of the background of your family?
So, I came from a relatively working class family in East Bristol, and I grew up in a family, a good Christian family, but not particularly wealthy. And that's all I say for now.
Okay, that's good. Well, let's talk to Chris real quick, and then Professor Tooley's going to go first, and then Chris will follow. And then Chris will kind of get the bridge going there. Now, Chris, you have been involved in business. You were instrumental with Opportunity International in helping really scale OI and its work. Tell us a little bit more, though, about your background and what it is that has kind of prepared you to do what you're doing now with Edify.
I was a businessman for 25 years. And then after I sold my company, Opportunity International asked me to come in and be the chief executive officer. And at first I declined. I thought, I didn't know anything about running a nonprofit. But in my daily scripture reading, the Lord's many commands, over 2,000 of them, to serve the poor started jumping off the page at me. And I realized, maybe I better look a little more closely at this. Perhaps I'm being called. So that was a terrific experience to be there for 7 years. And then while there, I did meet Professor Tooley about 6 years ago, and it identified for me that this terrific opportunity for profound and long-lasting transformation in the developing world. So then a couple years ago, I decided to focus exclusively on loans to sustainable Christian schools in the developing world.
So you obviously have a great resume that we've all seen and read a little bit about, but who would you say are two or three people that have had a big influence on your life, that have shaped some of the way you think about the world and the way you work in the world?
Thank you. Certainly my father, who never did have the chance to go to college, but he worked hard, and he would always say education is something that no one can take away from you, and it was always a given that I would go to college when I was growing up. He just had an enthusiasm and a man of great integrity. Then I had a mentor, a Christian businessman who was very successful, who ran his business by principles of integrity, of caring for others, of truly trying to meet market needs and help others, especially develop staff professionally. His name is Merrill Oster. And then Professor Tooley, having heard him speak 6 years ago, that changed the course of my life. So those three people.
That's great. Let me ask you one more question then. As you think about experiences in your life, were there two or three pivotal experiences, encounters that you may have had that you thought, I've got to do something to respond to this?
Yes. I had my company, I would go over with a group called Youth of the Mission to build homes for the poor in Mexico. I live in San Diego, so it's quite easy to go over to Tijuana, just about 30 miles away. And just when I saw the abject poverty and how hard people work to just eke out a living, to just barely feed their families. I thought there must be ways to come alongside people who are working so hard, not by giving them things, but by assisting them so that they could generate more resources for their family, and ideally then they would also grow closer to Christ in their relationship.
That's great. Thanks for giving us that little bit of background. Professor Tooley, I would imagine that since you spent a good portion of your career in England, that you would be saying to yourself, this is a fairly expected American way of introduction. This wouldn't be done at a British university. And so, like in learning theory, we talk about creating disequilibrium. I'm sure we've created disequilibrium here. But we'll turn the mic to you and let you kind of open our session and then welcome Dr. Craig.
Thank you very much indeed. I've come today with some good news and some further good news. The good news is that around the world today, the poor are finding a way of providing educational opportunities for themselves that is working and that is better than any alternative. And the funny thing is, it has not involved a single person in this room or at this conference or from outside. That's the first bit of good news. But the second bit of good news is that for those of us gathered here who feel they want to do something to help the poor in developing countries, then there are ways in which we can get involved in this process. And I'm speaking of low-cost private schools that are burgeoning throughout the developing world. I first discovered this for myself about 10 years ago in the old city of Hyderabad. Since we've started on this a personal vein, I flunked my personal questions earlier, but I should say that I had become an expert on private education in developing countries, but I was dissatisfied because I wanted to know what was happening with the poor. I felt I should be focused more on what the poor were doing. And so on a day off, I went down to the Charminar, the Arc de Triomphe of India in Hyderabad, where I'd read in my rough guide to India that the slums of the old city were behind that building. And I went down there on a day off and walked down an alleyway, bumped around for a while, and very quickly found what I was looking for. A low-cost private school, a private school in these poor communities, in those days charging the equivalent of about $1 per month. I left that school, went to another, and soon found another, and very quickly was introduced to a federation of around 500 of these low-cost private schools, all in the slums and low-income areas of the old city of Hyderabad. And I came away from that meeting, having met with parents and heard why they sent their children to these low-cost private schools, scrimping and saving in order to do so, rather than the government schools, which were free. I came back to Washington, D.C., really excited by what I'd found, thinking here was a solution for education for all that the poor were finding for themselves. And I came back to America. I was working in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I met with a complete and utter stonewall. The people at the World Bank told me, "Tooley, calm down. You've met a few businessmen ripping off the poor, nothing more." And I thought this didn't gel with what I'd seen at all. So fortunately, I managed to find a group that was more sympathetic, the John Templeton Foundation in Philadelphia. And I managed to get a grant from them to pursue this interest, and I did it in various countries, including Nigeria. This is Makoko, the shanty town built on stilts into the dark waters of the Lagos Lagoon as you go across to Victoria Island. And people said it's too dangerous to go there. You can't go there. So the next day I went there and in a canoe and found a private school, and then another. And we did a survey in that place and found 32 low-cost private schools charging a couple of dollars a day in that slum community. Went to Ghana, to somewhere more pretty in a way, but equally as poor, these fishing villages on the Coconut Grove, Atlantic coast. And there we found, yes, sure enough, a private school very quickly. Went to Kenya, to slums like Kibera here in Nairobi. And again, every time I went to these places, I would meet with people who should know better. People like yourselves sometimes. People from the education ministries. And they would tell me, "James, you may have found something interesting in India. In our country, in Kenya, in Nigeria, wherever, private schools are for the rich, for the elite. Private schools are not for the poor. you're on a hiding to nowhere. And so I'd say, oh, fine. We'd go to the slums the next morning. I'd say, let's see what we can find. And sure enough, we would find a private school and then another and another and another. But even in rural China, where perhaps you might think you've met your nemesis, after traveling for 2 days into these remote mountains in Gansu province in the northwest of China, one of the poorest places, getting hints that these schools existed in these places, again, in these remote mountains, at the end of a tremendous journey through places of extreme beauty, there would be low-cost private schools, in this case one primarily for girls, because the public school, which was available, was 4 or 5 hours walk through the mountains, and parents didn't want their girls doing that. We did large-scale surveys. In Nigeria, this is what the picture was like in Lagos State, but typical throughout. See the, I guess I've got a laser here, have I? I won't risk it. The blue, I think. The government, only a quarter of school children in poor areas of Lagos State are going to government schools. Fully three quarters are in these low-cost private schools. And you see that, the private unrecognized, 33%, the third of those children are in schools that are completely off the government radar. And I put the minimum reality there, because that was a survey we did a few, 3 or 5 years ago. The government itself now is reckoning the proportion in government schools has shrunk to about 15%. These private schools are massively growing and massively influential. We tested 24,000 children in our various studies, and the results were typically like this. This is from Delhi, maths on far side, English in the middle, Hindi this side, and the red is government scores, the blue is the private unrecognized, and the yellow is the private recognized, all low-cost private schools, all schools in poor areas. And again, you see these low-cost private schools are outperforming the government, and they're doing it for a fraction of the cost. So that's been something that I've been celebrating ever since. I wrote this book that I see has been provided for you, The Beautiful Tree, celebrating this phenomenon of the low-cost private schools. And the incredible thing about it, for those who are interested in development, is that already there is a sustainable development taking place here. These schools are generally individually sustainable, profitable. That's why there are so many of them. And they are scalable. There are a huge number of these schools. Maybe 300,000 in India, maybe 80,000 in Anglophone West Africa. And, you know, why are parents going to them? Well, meanwhile, in a government school near you, I took this photograph in Sierra Leone 2 or 3 weeks ago in the slums in Freetown. In the private schools, there was huge activity going on. There was a lot of activity. Teachers were there teaching. In the government school, meanwhile, there was nothing going on. The teachers in this case were on strike. But even when they're not on strike, this is a scene in a government school on the edge of the slum of Makoko in Lagos, Nigeria. I went with the BBC crew to film what's happening in the private schools, and then we got permission to go to the public schools. And we went with the assistant commissioner. We were announced, they knew we were coming and what time we were coming. And the very first classroom we entered in the public school, the teacher was fast asleep at his desk. The children jumped up to welcome us, still the teacher slept. And perhaps unkindly, I showed this clip on the BBC film we made with the voiceover of the Commissioner of Education saying, rather laconically, in the past we had problems with teachers, but now our manpower are well-disciplined and well-trained. But I wouldn't have shown that picture, and I wouldn't be showing it now, if this is not something you see in the government schools serving the poor all the time. Either nothing going on at all, teachers sleeping, or teachers not particularly teaching. In Ghana, where we're working very closely now, you'll find the teachers in the government schools have a nice arrangement. They have their desks outside of the classroom, on the veranda, because it's noisy and dirty and hot inside the classroom, so they sit outside the class, and where obviously not much teaching goes on. So, tremendous success story, tremendously exciting things happening around the world. There is in the book, that's the Indian version. But I said at the beginning, that's the good news in a sense. But it's perhaps not quite as good as I'm intimating there. Because in a sense, these are the three choices that are available for poor parents now. No school at all. Actually, that's perfectly rational for many poor parents if the government school is as useless as those schools that I've been describing. And it's not just our work that's describing schools in that way. All the top economists and education researchers are describing the dysfunctionality of these government schools. The low-cost private schools are certainly better, but if you can think about it really, the government schools have set such a low bar that the private schools can afford to be a little bit complacent and maybe not perform as well as they would want to. So we're looking at this fourth alternative, a higher quality low-cost private school. And Chris will tell you much more about an organization called Edify that's working across a range of schools. I want to tell you about a chain of schools that I've helped create, one of a couple of chains of schools I've created, one in India, this one's in Ghana. And the idea behind a chain of schools is, of course, that standalone schools can't really invest much in improving their quality, their teacher training, their investing in curriculum, trying out new ideas. I know you heard about the Khan Academy last night and so on. Individual standalone schools can't really afford that investment. If you get a chain of schools, then you can cover the overhead for your R&D and your curriculum development and your quality control through a margin coming from each school. And of course, as a larger organization, you can also get economies of scale. You can bring prices down. So we've created this chain of schools called Omega Schools, which just started 2 years ago. It's now reached 11 schools with 6,000 students. And crucially, it's achieved a break-even this year. And why is it so successful in a way? In a way, it's featuring this local knowledge of, you know, what the poor can and cannot do. And the insight we had with my local partner, Ken Donko, I'm working very closely with people in Ghana, the insight was actually the poor are daily wage earners. They're market traders, they're fishermen, they get daily, the money, the cash flow is daily. And yet typical private schools in Africa charge on the termly basis, every 3 or 4 months. So even if the fees now are, say, $5 per month equivalent, you've got to save up $15. As a poor person, that's very, very difficult. There are always other calls on your money. Saving is hard for a poor person. And then you find schools have additional charges. So you save up your $15, you go to a school, and then 2 weeks later the school says that now we need to pay your PTA fees. Now you need next week to pay the exam fees, and so on. There are additional fees. So we worked out a daily fee model. And this is, it's such a simple innovation, but it's proved immensely popular, so much so that when we open a school, within 10 days, these schools are full with 450, 500 students. And hence, of course, that's good for our cash flow and our profitability. But the schools are full because parents like this model, because we worked out that the total cost of the schooling for the tuition, for a nice lunch, for transport, for books, for textbooks, exercise books, for a computing lab, everything, and then added a few extra things like deworming and so on. We found that cost per pupil, if the schools were sufficiently full, came to 200 Ghanaian cedis per year. There are 215 days in a Ghanaian year, so the fees were one CD per day, and we give the children 15 free days per year. We don't give them a get-out-of-jail free card, we give them 5 get-into-school free cards every term, and they can use those when there's no cash in the house at all. And also, if they've got more money that day, if they've got 2 CDs that day, they can come along and they can buy one of these cards. So it acts as a sort of saving for a rainy day too. This is immensely successful. I think it shows the importance of local knowledge. I'll conclude with this slide here, though, which raises some questions, which I won't have time to go into. But obviously, we're concerned about improving educational quality. The teachers we're working with are generally untrained. We have to train them. We have to provide structured teaching methods around lesson plans, workbooks which keep the children recognizing what the structure should be.
peer learning, very simple ways of improving performance with peer learning, and thinking in terms of technology, finding, of course, costs are hard to control, but maybe costs are coming down the right direction. But thinking very seriously about how to improve what goes on in these schools against the national curriculum, the national testing, which constrains what we do somewhat. But I've run out of time here. I just want to summarize then that what I've described is existing across developing world. It's in Latin America, it's in Africa, it's in Asia. And typically in poor areas, you'll find the majority of school children are in low-cost private schools, which are outperforming the government schools at a fraction of the cost. And we here who are concerned about helping the poor educationally have ways of helping them. And one of the ways is thinking about how to help improve quality. Another way is the way that Chris is pioneering. And Chris, I'll hand over to you now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James, very much. It is really remarkable that this chain of schools, which James has founded, is charging only $5 per month in school fees and another $11 a month for lunches and uniforms and a bus to take the students back and forth and textbooks and exam fees. It's really remarkable that of the quality educational service that James provides in his chain of schools in Ghana, and we're very pleased to be providing loans to those chain of schools. I'm very excited to have the chance to speak with you about a solution to one of the greatest problems in the world. There are at least 1 billion children out of the 7 billion people in the world. I saw a news report the other day that now we've just crossed the 7 billion line. At least 1 billion children in the developing world are receiving there are 1 billion children. The UN says that 7% of those children have no access to schools whatsoever. And then there's, in my estimation, there's another 60% or 600 million of those children that are receiving a very poor education. So that means two-thirds of the developing world's children are receiving a very poor education. And the ramifications of that are that those children will then be relegated to, virtually sentenced to, like a prison sentence, to dire poverty for the 50 years after they get out of school. And they will be doing manual labor in the 95-degree heat and the 95% humidity that exists in so many of these countries almost every day. And not using the good minds that they have, not using their God-given talents, that they just go fallow. It's a tragedy. One of the major reasons that these schools are so poor, the ones that exist, the public schools, these are the government-financed schools, is teacher absenteeism. James referred to that. James and I were in Ghana just in April visiting schools together. We went to a public school. It was announced. We went accompanied by a foundation who had made a significant grant to that public school, and 4 of the 14 teachers were present. 10 of the 14 teachers were absent. It's just amazing. Had our visit not been announced, probably 12 of the 14 teachers would have been absent. This is commonplace. They can't be fired. They're in the union. They get paid no matter what. In some countries, as long as they're giving 10% to the principal of their salary, 10% to the district superintendent, they don't have to show up at all. And that is what happens. Typically, 10% in many developing world countries of the teachers never show up. And so it's so disappointing. They are stealing from these children. But that's the way it is. In Ghana, my friends, West Africa, my friends call the public schools soccer academies. So the first time they said this, I said, well, why do you call them that? They said, get in the car. We'll go drive by a few. So as we drove by several public schools, no matter what time of the day it is, there will be hundreds of children outside playing soccer. The teacher doesn't show up, and the administration sends them out to play soccer. So who watched the World Cup? The World Cup soccer matches last summer. So good. So Steve, you watched it. So do you remember Ghana played the United States? Do you remember what happened? The score when Ghana played the United States? Anybody remember? Just who won? So Ghana defeated the United States. 4 years earlier, 2006, Ghana defeated the United States. So even though the U.S. has 20 times the population of Ghana, it is, or 15 times the population, it's unfair. It's unfair that the U.S. has to play Ghana, because the problem is the children in Ghana spend 6 hours a day playing soccer when they should be in school. They get no homework. Then they play 4 hours of soccer after school. And so by the time, I've run the numbers, by the time they're age 18 or 20, they've got 30,000 hours of playing soccer. How can we expect the U.S. with, 15 times the population to ever beat Ghana? So it's in our national interest to get these children back in school, and that they're not playing soccer, they're learning things academically. So these affordable private schools, there are hundreds of thousands of these in the developing world. James has already alluded to that. And so they charge typically $5 to $15 per month. They provide a much better education. And the parents are earning $2 a day, $3 a day. And so you might be asking, how can they possibly do that? How can they? So if a school is costing, let's say, $8 a month, and those parents have three children, that's $24 a month. But the mother is earning $2 a day, working 25 days a month, that's $50. The father, same thing, $2 a day, 25 days a month, another $50. Combined, they're earning $100. They will spend 24% of their income to send their children to school, because they know that's the one chance in life for these children. That's the ticket out of poverty for their children. They love their children. That's their number one reason. The second reason is that in these countries, there's no safety net. There's no Social Security. The custom is that the children take care of their parents in their old age. So if you're one of those parents, let's say you're now retired, you're in old age, would you rather have your child earning $2 a day or $20 a day? That's a pretty easy decision. So if we can get that to work. There we go. And these schools are sustainable. So you might ask, shit, $8 a month, how does that work? So let's say there are 30 children in a classroom paying $8 a month. In that one classroom, that's $240 in revenues. The teacher is typically paid $60 a month, so that's $180 in gross margin left over to pay the janitor, the bookkeeper, for the proprietor to make a living, and to make a debt service payment, to make a loan repayment on the loan they took out to build a classroom or a computer lab or to buy a used van to get the children to and from schools. So that's just per classroom. They typically have 6, 8, 10 classrooms, so they can generate significant funds to repay the loans that they receive. So there are the three major approaches to providing education. So when Westerners decide to come in and to provide education and perhaps build a school, there are three ways that that's usually done. The traditional way is to donate the building and then to donate the expenses every year. So when that happens, and it's been done most of the time it's done that way, it's highly likely that that school is not being run very efficiently, because all the funds come in, the administration, it just comes in. So I have a friend who's a retired physician in San Diego, and so he heard what I was doing. He called me up because he was experiencing a problem. He had built two schools in Zambia, and the schools were constantly calling them up for more money. And so their latest call, he explained, is they had said, gee, you're only paying the teachers $300 a month. I was amazed that's a very high price. And he said the administration now told him he really should be paying the teachers $1,200 a month, so please dramatically increase the money he's sending over. So I just explained, doctor, and he knew that was an unrealistic price. I said, doctor, the problem is that they've got you over a barrel. You built these two schools. You don't want them to go under. They're just asking you for more money, and they're spending their time thinking about how they can get more money from you rather than running that school efficiently or even making it sustainable. But that's the traditional methodology. Another methodology is donate the building, and then after the building's free and clear, then charge fees that will cover all of the operating expenses. So a hybrid sustainable model. After the building is built, then it's sustainable. The third approach is the one that's the newer approach, the one that we're working with, some other organizations are working with, that is make a loan for the classroom or the entire school building, have it repaid over several years, then you can loan out those funds, recycle them to another school, and just keep recycling that. And then so it's totally sustainable. The school is sustainable. That's repaid, the cost of the school, and the fees. They're charging enough fees each year to be sustainable plus make debt payments. The big difference between number two and number three, and even number one. So number one and number two is that the school building is built, and in 5 years there's still only one building, and 10 years there's one building, and it, on and on. On the third model, the lower model there, the schools propagate. So let's say a loan is made to a school and it builds an entire school, and that school pays back in 5 years. Then at the end of the 5 years, then it's loaned out again, and then there are two schools with the same original capital. In 10 years, there are three schools, 15 years, four. So in 20 years, you have five schools for the same original capital because the schools are propagating. They pay back the loan so they can be recycled to other schools. Very important item in scaling up. So the lending model that we use and some other organizations use are no grants or subsidies. We don't give anything to anybody. And so that for a lot of people, it's a foreign concept. It's a difficult concept. It's just unusual. So Tom McCauley sitting in the back row. So when I first explained this concept to Tom, Tom said, Chris, in the same sentence, you're using two mutually exclusive phrases. You're saying low cost, sustainable Christian schools. You're saying that educating the poor. And you're saying over here, you're saying sustainable. So low-cost schools educating the poor, sustainable. That can't be. Those don't go together, right? I said, no, Tom, they go together. So they really are, these are sustainable schools that educate the children of impoverished parents. So we work with a trusting lending partner in the field. This is typically an organization that does small and medium enterprise lending or microfinance lending. They'll have 100, 200, 300 loan officers already there. We give them the parameters of the schools we want to finance, and then they go out, find these schools, make the loans, collect the loans, and recycle the loans to other schools. And the schools repay with interest, so they repay with enough interest to cover that lender's costs, and then the principal's put back into an account that's recycled to other schools. So the money recycles. It's very efficient. These proprietors are... Their livelihood depends on providing a good educational service. Otherwise, the parents will pull their children out of that school and send them to a different school. And they are very focused on managing costs carefully. And over the period of years, because of the recycling, it ends up being about $8.47 per student year of education, say over a 20-year period. So, $10,000 builds two classrooms. These schools are sustainable. So that, let's say, 35 children in a classroom. So for 30 years, that same $10,000 will educate those 70 children a year. But then actually they're propagating more, classrooms and schools. So there'll be many, many more children educated than that number. Churches also, one of the things that we do is we find a church. The building's already there. There's no incremental facilities costs. So we'll make a loan to them where they have inexpensive plywood dividers and they can divide off the church building and turn it into a school. This allows for the pastor to focus full time on, instead of having a job elsewhere during the week, that he or she is focused in on providing a good Christian transformation to the children. That building's empty 6 days a week anyway, so why not use it, given that it's already there? So we focus on excellent academics, but life skills as well. Christian transformation, to extend teaching the principles of Jesus, of integrity, of caring for others, of service, of being honest in business dealings. English is the language of the world, a language of commerce in the world. Computers is another fast becoming a language of commerce in the world. So we want them to have computer skills and entrepreneurship. There are so few jobs when these children available when they get out of high school. There's so few jobs. that they have to become job creators, not job seekers. So we teach them how to identify an opportunity in the market, how to differentiate their product, how to provide good customer service, how to do a simple cash flow analysis, and we can refer them when they graduate to some of the microfinance partners that we have so they can get funding for their opportunities. We try to give them, we work with Junior Achievement in some schools, there are lots of other organizations that we can partner with and we have partnered with that give them some hands-on entrepreneurship experience even while they're at school. If you have ideas on helping us in any of these areas, you have expertise, please go to our website, let us know. We've identified a number of projects that we'd love for people with expertise to come alongside and assist with us. So, here's a chart that's got lots of information on it. I invite your attention to the green line that's sloping up. This shows how an organization can scale up rapidly to meet this need. This happens to be the projection for our organization, but we're showing by 2017 that we will have financed schools, or hope to have financed schools, Lord willing, with 1 million children in those schools. We made our first loan 16 months ago. We financed 404 schools in that time, impacting about 78,000 children. So this can be scaled up rapidly. So this concept, this model, is to address and overcome some of the greatest problems in the world today. So illiteracy. So the USAID did a study in Ghana, and they said that 85% of people 15 years and older in Ghana, West Africa, are functionally illiterate. So that's a shame. There are a lot of good minds that never got a good education. So addressing illiteracy, corruption. In most of the countries that we work, there is a culture of corruption. So we believe through Christian transformation that we can train these children. We work with them for 8 and 10 and 12 years that they, if they believe they're accountable to God, when that opportunity presents itself to ask for a bribe or someone asks them to pay a bribe, that they will say no, that they will overcome, that when we are educating enough children in that country, there'll be critical mass, that we can transform that culture of corruption to a culture of honesty. And then unemployment, where these children will come out of school, they'll become managers in businesses, or perhaps they'll start their own businesses, and they'll employ other people. So we think this is world-changing. This model is scalable. It can scale up rapidly. It's sustainable. These loans are paid back. They're recycled by other schools, and they are leverageable. My spell check didn't like leverageable as one word. So when we provide loans to our financing partners, our lending partners in country, they often can access the capital markets. So if we make a loan of $100,000 to them, they'll go to the capital markets, borrow another $100,000, they'll loan out $200,000. So this is leverageable. This is an opportunity to scale up rapidly. We're trying to bring lots of other organizations, get them interested in this field. Professor Tooley has traveled all over the world giving speeches, encouraging others to get in this field, because this is a chance to truly change the world, to educate many of those, some 670 million children in the developing world who have just such a poor education now. But we can that can be changed, that they receive a good education, that they have the principles. Yesterday, Charles Koch, when he received his award, said, if you hire someone evil, hope that person is slow and dumb. Warren Buffett says when he's hiring senior executives, he looks for three things. High intelligence, high energy, and high intelligence. And if they don't have the third one, the high integrity, the first two are a liability. We don't want to train up people just in academics to be better at corruption in their countries. We are seeking to transform them so that they will be able to address this problem of corruption, that they will be able to transform the societies that they live, their families, their communities, and their countries. Thank you very much for coming today. Thank you for your interest in education.